The Intangible Economies Project initially came about simply because I became aware that economic forms had started to appear in some of my own works, less as a main feature, but more as an underlying principle operative in the form of structures of exchange or representation. However, since I wasn't really dealing with the economy in the popular sense of the word, that is, the economy as represented by all aspects of finance and capital, but more in this broader sense, I became interested in figuring out the shape of this thing called economy. What are actually its defining characteristics? How does or could it manifest? In what ways is it meaningful as both a practical phenomenon and a philosophical construct? And perhaps most importantly, what conditions the particular shapes it takes and what do these formations express? As mentioned, economy could, for example, be regarded simply as a structure of exchange rather than a construct that describes the fairly abstract flows of goods and capital. We could consider it as a system in which what we call exchange is actually a sort of dialectical operation that creates representation. The abstract and abstracting function of value here then becomes the fulcrum of the system that I want to encourage, and I want to encourage a consideration of the term value that includes both such materialist interpretations of the word as use value and exchange value, but also for it to express the notion of ethical value. Even the seemingly simple establishment of a good's value, meaning the establishment of what it can be represented by, for example, we might say that a sack of rice is worth the same as a chair, is ultimately very complex. It involves material, land, and people. All of these elements must connect in very particular ways in order to get to the point where we can say, here we have a sack of rice, and its value is equivalent to that of this chair. And perhaps it's important to note that the process of abstraction that is inherent to this operation and that is at once the base of any system of representation is also integral to Marx's theory of alienation. But focusing on this abstraction, I seem to describe the economy as a kind of inanimate, mechanized system. However, and that is the crux of this entire forum, if an economy is considered a system of exchange, it requires actors that perform that exchange. So economy is by definition social. And different from an ecology, it is not natural in the sense that it doesn't rely on originary processes such as, for example, photosynthesis or something like that. Instead, while fundamental to human nature, it is always man-made and therefore inflected by how people have been and are constructing this thing we call economy. And it is therefore necessary to recognize that economic dynamics do not just proceed parallel to social dynamics, but really operate as an articulation of social structures. And what seems necessary then is to emphasize that the social is based on actual individual relationships, and while on a societal level, these take on more structured and organized forms, be they as discourses, associations, unions, and all that Foucault describes as the dispositif, up to the complexity of governmental structures, all of that is rooted in interpersonal relationships. These relationships are affective and frequently produced by economic activity. For example, in the process of trade and the division of labor. Conversely, affect, and in particular desire, also generates economic transaction, and it is to be considered a fundamental motor of any capitalist economy. It is the needing and wanting that demands to be satisfied by goods or immaterial values such as care, attention, or love, and it is what fuels innovation. The gift plays a pivotal role in thinking about the economy in this context because it is so deeply bound up with notions of affectivity, and while the idea of the gift as paying for something forms a little bit of a taboo, we also clearly understand that the gift can engender a kind of debt. Marcel Mauss establishes that far from being an aberration of modern economies, the gift forms the foundation of these very economies, and he points to the inexorable connection between the economy and the notion of moral values in their enactment through interpersonal relationships. In the introduction of his seminal essay, The Gift, the Form and Reason of Poor Exchange in Archaic Societies, Mao sets out the parameters of his inquiry, stating that contractual morality, namely the law relating to things, even today remains linked to the law relating to persons. He goes on to reflect on the various societies on which the empirical study for his essay is based. And he states, and again I quote, "The market is a human phenomenon that, in our view, is not foreign to any known society, but whose system of exchange is different from ours. In these societies, we shall see the market as it existed before the institution of traders and before their main invention, money proper. We shall see how it functioned both before the discovery of forms of contract and sale that may be said to be modern, and also before money, minted and inscribed. We shall see the morality and the organization that operate such transactions. As we shall note that this morality and organization still function in our own societies in unchanging fashion and, so to speak, hidden below the surface, as we believe that in this we have found one of the human foundations on which our societies are built, we shall be able to deduce a few moral conclusions concerning certain problems posed by the crisis of our own law and economic organization." So Mao mentions a crisis in this passage that I just quoted, and that, of course, takes us back to the present day. My own initial thinking about this whole idea of economies started in probably in early 2008, where up to that point, the whole notion of the financial crisis was still sort of just a rumor that you heard in sort of obscure late night radio shows or something like that. Until, of course, then in late 2008, it fully hit. But what's interesting in terms of this notion of crisis is, of course, the fact that it is the point where what's been taken for granted up to that point is suddenly in question, and in a very precarious and volatile way. Which, of course, is also a beautiful opening for discourse. So what ensued since 2008 has been a somewhat broader discussion of such topics as value, credit, debt, and exchange. And there have been a plethora of newspaper articles, books, new and reissued, documentaries, plays, and of course exhibitions, all attempting to grasp the disappearance of some fundamental certainties and to figure out this new economic landscape with all of its ramifications. Importantly also, an interrogation of values in the broader sense started to occur. Initially, in popular media, this did not extend much further than a public pondering of the ethical integrity of stockbrokers and of financial institutions. However, already prior to the crisis, numerous theorists from diverse disciplines had begun to call attention to the fact that the financial crisis is but the very tip of an issue much larger than even mere neoliberalism. Interestingly also, it seems that recently an entirely different type of engagement with the crisis has come into being with the Occupy movement. Different in the sense that this movement seems to employ quite distinct modes of communication and discourse, as evidenced, for example, in the call and response format of public address, the deliberate refusal to define clear, overarching demands that are otherwise considered fundamental to a productive public dialogue, and the renewed attention to the poetics of the placard as a kind of antique version of the Twitter feed, as well as a kind of image or soundbite that's really perfectly sized to be redistributed through social media. So Mao mentions a crisis, and indeed his essay The Gift was published in 1923-24, so just a few years prior to the Great Depression, which was, for those who can't remember, was 29 to 33, and importantly perhaps contemporaneously with the Great Inflation Crisis in Germany, which was from 1914 to 23. Over the past century, there have been numerous books, some of them considered seminal, that touch on the entanglement of economy and effect. So in addition to Marcel Mauss's writings, for example, there were George Bataille's The Accursed Chair, which came out 46 to 49, and Jean-François Lyotard's Liberal Economy in 1974. All of them were written during or around significant crises, including the Great Depression, the Second World War, as well as the Vietnam War and the student revolts that followed the late 60s, or that took place in the late 60s. So what seems obvious is the inextricable interconnection between the precariousness of a crisis, the inherent revolutionary potential of such a crisis, and the irrational or affective force that arises from this mix. And what this volatile mix seems to force is a reflection on what really matters existentially, what is of essential value, and then to open up into a kind of messy utopianism. Notably, perhaps, when we think of these just mentioned crises and pictures, what we can conjure are often accumulations of people. People in lineups, people in military formations, people huddled in shelters, or people protesting. These images perhaps come to mind most immediately because of their affective charge. When looking at them, we recognize in them the strange power of physical proximity in large groups of people, how there is this volatile energy that both fuels and seems to resist the drive of the crowd to represent itself to itself. And this mysterious dynamic of affect, representation, and the social as it pertains to economic structures will particularly feature in diverse ways in various presentations this weekend. Hadley Max's original presentation, used as its matrix, no theater or no theater script, looked at an economy of representation that took its cue a little bit from theater. And that has remained, but I think the crowd thing is gone somewhere else. So, and the same actually with Melanie Gilligan. Melanie Gilligan also was going to speak much more, I think, about the crowd, and I think that might have, the emphasis might have shifted a little bit. But Candace Hopkins is still talking about a crowd situation. The golden potlatch that I referred to earlier that she's gonna address was very much characterized by a kind of parade culture, and again, that requires people both performing and viewing. What these contributions to the forum maybe share in particular is the question of the aforementioned representation in the sense of this performative representation, and that involves live, real-time physical presence of its actors and audience through, although I think the lines between audience and actors are really quite diffuse in these situations. And this type of presentation may be based on the notion of a script, like for a play, for a film, or a parade. But what comes to the fore here as well is the notion of the script as an authoritative history, as law, and law as an expression of an ethic, which in turn takes us back to the notion of value. Now that I've talked a little bit about the economy, I just want to talk about affect a little. I have spoken in almost interchangeably about affect and desire so far, and although I acknowledge that they're not the same, and the whole project actually started with me thinking about economies of affect, but it became clear pretty quickly that that was kind of too narrow, and I wanted to broaden it a bit more. So it also then became necessary to actually think about what are the differences between affect, emotion, sense experience, and maybe feeling. And what I found really useful in thinking about that was actually Xian Gai's book, Ugly Feelings. And she provides a very, very practical kind of, or useful characterization. In referring to Brian Massumi, Gai states that affect can be defined in comparison to emotion like this. And I quote, "Emotion requires a subject, while affect does not, but the former designates feeling given function and meaning, while the latter remains unformed and unstructured." And of course, then one must ask at some point, what generates all this affect and emotion? And again, it becomes clear that these phenomena arise from our interaction with the world and the way in which we sense it. So just to be clear, I don't just mean intellectual engagement with our environment, but perhaps much more importantly, embodied experience. While sense experience is largely considered to have a sort of authentic quality, it is important to recognize that as soon as the sense experience transitions into cognition, meaning an articulated mode, it becomes culturally inflected. In her examination of cultural forms, and that is in her case primarily literature and film, Guy states that, and I quote again, "Feelings are as fundamentally social as the institutions and collective practices that have been the more traditional objects of historicist criticism, and as material as the linguist signs and significations that have been the more traditional objects of literature's formalism. Although feeling is not reducible to these institutions, collective practices, or discursive significations, it is nonetheless as socially real and as infrastructural in its effects as a factory." So again, the changes, I think we see a lot of these topics addressed later on by Hadley and Maxwell. Melanie will talk about them tomorrow, and Olaf and I will be discussing them in the afternoon as well. I would now like to turn briefly to one of the ubiquitous material objects that immediately come to mind when thinking about the economy, and that's money. And I'd like to look at banknotes briefly, just to provide a little bit more context, and partially also because I'm just totally seduced by the beauty of a lot of these banknotes. And I think they're also there, just even though they're sort of on the verge of being obsolete, I think they're really still very pertinent in the sense that a lot of economic, but also semiotic, aesthetic, social, and political issues find expression in them. And I think we see on Sunday, Juan and Jan will address that format, the money, a little bit as well. So while paper currency's evocative potential is as strangely invisible as it is ubiquitous, and at various times throughout the history of paper money, there's been a striking analogy, both formally and with regard to said symbolic potential, between what is considered art and what is relegated to the practicalities of a cash economy. In fact, it would seem that contemporary concepts of the artwork would make it imperative to acknowledge this collective fiction that centers around the exchange of little bits of paper as the ready-made artwork it has been all along. Representative money, as in promissory notes and other currency whose material value is less than its face value, emerged during the Dutch Golden Age, with its now famous credit crisis engendered by a craze for tulips. Parallel to the rise of representative money, a change in social hierarchies took place. Social position that was previously primarily based on bloodlines now became based pretty much exclusively on wealth and possession. While debt as such was rendered abstract in the increasing pervasiveness of representative money, the object, the piece of paper, had to become a stand-in for the personal, emotional, and affective bond that debt represents. Elaborate and careful ornamentation not only rendered the bills more forgery-proof, but also signaled the seriousness of the documented commitment through labor and attention invested in the designs. And this is primarily why I brought up this really crazily Baroque decorated bill, even though it's from much later, from 1893. This depersonalization of debt can be considered as but one facet of a broader set of concerns during the 17th and 18th century that heralded the beginning of modernity. The role of the monetary economy relative to social structures is highlighted again in 1920s Germany with its now famous culture of Notgeld, emergency money. And that was exactly this the money that came into circulation during the inflation crisis I mentioned earlier. And just to elaborate that a little bit more, what happened was basically through the war effort, Germany was printing money like crazy, and the inflation took up so much speed that money couldn't be printed fast enough. So communities basically printed their own money, sometimes on foil, on fabric, because there was not enough paper around even. So it became a very local, locally based operation. And so paper money, paper currency was a carrier in a way of proto-democratic structures, both in 17th century Holland with its burgeoning bourgeois culture and in 1920s Germany, by acting essentially as a medium to ascertain a certain freedom of expression and autonomy. Contemporary social initiatives that create local alternative currencies, such as the Ithaca Hours, the Totnes Pound, attest to this continuing utopian potential found in monetary structures. And that's also true for the STELO, the monetary unit of the Esperantists, in effect until 1993. So what remains at issue to the present day, it seems, is the need to represent the largely abstracted social bonds that arise from economic structures and the effective values that are always negotiated alongside economic structures. Present-day artworks reflect this, the metaphysical force of the monetary economy as a project and the desire to make visible the emotional charges, the social bonds, that a world of globalized capital has largely succeeded in obscuring, emerge crystal clear in works such as those by Julieta Aranda and Anton Vidocle, Danica Phelps, or Santiago Serra. These artists recharge the existing economic system with what seems to have gotten lost under the super differentiated conditions of capitalist production. One of the difficulties, I would say, dealing with this topic of economies and effect lies in its cross-disciplinarity. And on one hand, the consideration of the economy seems to be caught in too limited a sphere of inquiry, but also in a way in too limited a mode of inquiry. So while that's a difficulty, on the other hand, that also seems to represent its potential, I think. So it seems clear that in the pursuit of scientific or academic analysis, certain processes must be isolated in order to be properly understood. And it's also evident that the sciences for a long time shied away from acknowledging such amorphous and unquantifiable forces as affect and desire. But conventional theoretical texts on the economy seem to have a blind spot regarding such notions as desire and affect unless they are considered in terms of their marketability, quantifiability, or in the ways in which they may increase or decrease productivity. However, if this inquiry is not approached based on what makes sense as a neat abstract construct, but instead is concerned with the understanding of an experiential or even existential reality, an isolated examination of social, affective, and desirous mechanisms, and those that constitute what we call the economy cannot be sufficient. So this project's title, Intangible Economies, points to a key aspect I have asked the invited contributors to consider. The term intangible has entered into the conventional teachings of economics and various other discourses such as law, where it variously describes such assets that cannot be physically measured or that can literally not be touched. The word is used to describe such phenomena as employee morale, quality of life, or copyright. And where it was Mauss's endeavor to lift what cannot be touched into a scientific discourse, it was Jacques Derrida's project in Given Time, Counterfeit Money, to establish the notion of the gift that is so central to Mauss's project as extra-symbolic. For Derrida, any gift understood as such or intended as such by the donor or recipient ceases to deserve the designation of gift, something freely given without implied obligation of return. Hence, Derrida's gift defines itself as external to an economy of exchange. Considered like that, it refuses the representation that is fundamental to the notion of the symbolic order. In other words, any form of representation can be regarded as an economic transaction, a measuring and valuing of what can stand in for what, and consequently, one must conclude that the symbolic order itself is an economy of sorts. Derrida writes, and I quote, "A gift that would neither give itself nor give itself as such, and that could not take place except on the condition of not taking place, and of remaining impossible without dialectical sublation of the contradiction, to desire to think the impossible, to desire to give the impossible, this is obviously madness. The discourse that orders itself on this madness cannot let itself be contaminated by it. It's the end of quote. So why attempt the impossible? The Slovenian philosopher Rado Rihar stated, "An idea is a Lebensakt. An idea is an act of living, an existential act." This struck me as a profound statement, and particularly in the context of this series, which is a project, after all, that trades in ideas expressed primarily through language rather than, say, images, objects, or gestures. It is, in its necessary abstraction, even the most basic linguistic articulation requires an act of faith, namely that the signified is, in fact, being transmitted by the signifier. The exchange of complex abstract ideas multiplies this miraculous transmission of meaning to the nth power. Yet ideas can signify only in a dialectical matrix, an exchange, and they accrue value only in their circulation. It's the sometimes mind-boggling abstraction of ideas traded, especially in the context of philosophy, that points out the pivotal role that ideas play in the economy of desire. The idea will always be more connective than the realization of that idea. Since it is an individually idealized construct, it is embedded in a desirous libidinal order. And ironically, it is precisely the misunderstandings on which a shared idea is inevitably based that makes it so connective and so powerful as a social bond. The mechanisms I just described with regard to language and ideas could neatly be transferred to money, which functions like a floating signifier. It too signifies only by way of circulation, asserts value only through exchange, and faith is similarly involved insofar as we must trust that a dirty little bit of paper stands in for something that has use value rather than just exchange value. This trust, in fact, is not only by definition a social function, but it performs the miracle that alchemists long pursued in order to transform base metals into gold. We perform this miracle every day when we push a dollar bill across a cashier's counter. And importantly, this philosopher's stone, thought to be capable of turning base metals into gold, was sometimes also believed to be an elixir of life that is a basic creative force. So if the topic at hand, economies and their relation to affect, forms a crucial point of confluence that not only requires a grasp of numerous areas of knowledge, but necessitates attempts to transcend the attendant epistemological structures. This can be achieved, in my opinion, only by mobilizing an irreverence that by definition is not rational, but that itself is effective. Of course, a project such as Intangible Economies can put forth only propositions with a limited reach, and the aim is neither to present a complete picture nor to summarize or take the temperature of this discourse and the art activities that could be considered in its purview. In a sense, what I have asked of the contributors to this project to do is really fraught with pitfalls, because to do the topic justice, one must likely approach it very speculatively and embark on ways of thinking, writing, and presenting that are deeply contestable, because almost by definition, one must fall short of the topic's complexity. Yet perhaps the task of tackling this expanded notion of an economy and can only productively fall to artists, writers, and curators and others in the so-called cultural industry, precisely because here's a field of inquiry where categories are fluid and a certain mixture of dilettantism, which to me translates into fearlessness, and extraordinary expertise meet. I felt that there needed to be a way in which one could address this phenomenon in forms other than those determined exclusively by an analytic language or as filtered through the very specific academic discourses. And some of this questioning began through simply conversations with friends and colleagues. And some of those friends and colleagues had already been working with this topic for an extended period, as for example, Melanie Gilligan and Juan Gaitan. And some were working on projects in which I could see an economic at work, like, for example, in Monika Sevcik's project, The Art of Conversation. She might not have considered it in that that way, but to me, the notion of conversation, of verbal exchange, implied an economy of ideas that is really fundamental to this project. Although Monika's current contribution has a different focus, this was the starting point of our whole dialogue. And I think in some ways it's maybe also exemplary of the way in which the whole project came about, and where I really wanted for people to kind of shake up the ideas that I had of the economy, and not just the economy, of this complex of affect and economy, the connections, the kind of the resonances. And one of the most difficult and most pleasing things when things changed and people went off into directions that I hadn't anticipated. And so I really hope that this weekend, this kind of thing can continue with your contributions as well. So I'm really hoping that there will be dialogue either at the bar or through the respondent sessions and so on. Thanks.